16, and then just the translation and purport for the others. Is 15 up there? Oh, it's not up there. Okay, so I'll just read it. Sa itam prati buddhatma chitriketur vijoktipi grihanda kupan naskranta sarakpaka diva vipa. Translation. Thus enlightened by the instructions of the Brahmanans, Angira and Narada, King Chitraketu became fully aware of spiritual knowledge. As an elephant becomes freed from a muddy reservoir of water, King Chitraketu came out of the dark well of family life. Text number 16. Kalindriyam vidivatsnatva krita punya jalakriya maunina samyata prano brahma putrav avandata. Translation. The king bathed in the water of the Jamuna, and according to prescribed duties, he offered oblations of water to the forefathers and the demigods. Very gravely controlling his senses and mind, he then offered his respects and obeisances to the sons of Lord Brahma, Angira and Narada. 17. Okay, 18 and 19. Okay, two. Ata tasmai pranayaya bhaktaya prayatatmane. Bhagavan narada prito vidyame tam uvachaha. Translation. Thereafter, being very much pleased with Chitraketu, who was a self-controlled devotee and surrendered soul, Narada, the most powerful sage, spoke to him the following transcendental instructions. Okay, so 18 and 19 are on the board, right? Okay. Om namas tubhyam bhagavate vasudevaya dhimahi pradyumna yanir rudaya nama shankashanaya cha namo. Is that up there too?
No.
Oh, that's not up there. Okay, because there's two parts to this. It's 18 and 19 combined. So we'll stick to 18 and 19, then I'll do 19 afterwards. Om namas. Om namas. Tubhyam bhagavate. Vasudevaya. Dhimahi. Pramyuna. Yani Rudyaya Nama Shankarshanaya Cha Om Namastubhyam Bhagavate
Om Namastubhyam Bhagavate
Vasudevaya Dhimahi Pramyuna Yani Rudyaya Pradyumna yani rudyaya namak sankshar shanaya cha om namas tubhyam bhagavate vasudeva dhimahi pramyuna yani rudyaya namak sankshanaya cha. Namastubhyam bhagavate vasudevaya dhimahi namak sankarsanaya cha om namastubhyam bhagavate vasudevaya dhimahi Naya Rudaya
Namasankarsanaya
dhimahi. Pramunaya dhanrujaya. Namah sankarsanaya cha. Bhagavate. Vasudevaya dhimahi. Pradyumnyayana yugraya. Mansanshanyanaya cha.
Ladies.
Namastubhyam bhagavate. Vasudevaya dhimahi. Pradyumnyayana yugraya. Namah sankarsanaya cha.
No one else? Okay, the second part of that it's verse 19.
Namo vijnana matraya paramanda murtaye atmaramaya shantaya nivritta vaitadrishtaye.
Do the word for word?
Om,
O my Lord,
Namah,
obeisances,
Tubhyam,
unto you,
Bhagavate,
the Supreme Personality of Godhead,
Vasudevaya,
Krishna, the Son of Vasudev,
Dhimahi,
let me meditate upon,
Pradyumnaya,
unto Pradyumna,
Anirudhaya,
unto Aniruddha,
Nama,
respectful obeisances,
Sankarsanaya,
unto Lord Sankarsan,
Cha,
also,
Nama,
all obeisances,
Vijnana Matraya,
unto the form full of knowledge,
Paramananda Murtaye,
full of transcendental bliss,
Atma Adamaya,
unto the Lord who is self-sufficient,
Shantaya,
and free from disturbances,
Nivritta Dvaita Drishtaye,
whose vision turns away from duality, or who is one without a second. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Narada gave Chitraketu the following mantra. O Lord, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, who are addressed by the Omkara, Pranava, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. O Lord Vasudev, I meditate upon you. O Lord Pradyumna, Lord Aniruddha, and Lord Sankarsan, I offer you my respectful obeisances. O reservoir of spiritual potency, O spiritual bliss, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you, who are self-sufficient and most peaceful. O ultimate truth, one without a second, you are realized as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, and are therefore the reservoir of all knowledge. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. So we should all repeat this, because this is a wonderful prayer that we should pray. We should recite according to the instructions of Narada Muni. Narada gave Chitraketu the following mantra. O Lord, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, you are addressed by the Omkara Pranava. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. O Lord Vasudev, I meditate upon you. O Lord Pradyumna, Lord Aniruddha, and Lord Sankarsan, I offer you my respectful obeisances. O reservoir of spiritual potency, O supreme bliss, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. who are self-sufficient and most peaceful. O ultimate truth, one without a second, you are realized as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, and are therefore the reservoir of all knowledge. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. Okay, let's see if I can take it from here. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that he is, it's too dark. He is Pranava Sarva Vedeshu, the syllable Om in the Vedic mantras. In transcendental knowledge, the Lord is addressed as Pranava, Omkara, which is a symbolic representation of the Lord in sound. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Vasudev, who is an expansion of Narayan, expands himself as Pradyumna, Aniruddha, and Shankarshan. From Shankarshan comes a second Narayan expansion, and from this Narayan come further expansions of Vasudev, Pradyumna, Shankarshan, and Aniruddha. The Shankarshan in this group is the original cause of the three Purushas, namely Karanadakshai Vishnu, Garbhadakshai Vishnu, and Shiradakshai Vishnu. Shiradakshai Vishnu is situated in every universe in a special planet called Svetadvip. This is confirmed in the Brahma Samhita, Andantarastha. The word Anda means universe. Within this universe is a planet called Svetadvip, where Shiradakshai Vishnu is situated. From him come all the incarnations within this universe. As confirmed in the Brahma Samhita, all these forms of the Supreme Personality of Godhead are Advaita, non-different, and they are also Achyuta, infallible. They do not fall down like the conditioned souls. The ordinary living entity is prone to falling into the clutches of Maya, but the Supreme Lord in his different incarnations and forms is Achyuta, infallible. Therefore, his body is different from the material body possessed by the conditioned soul. The word matra is explained in the Medini Dictionary as follows. Matra karna vibhushayam vite mane padichade. The word matra in its different imports is used to indicate the decoration of the ear, possession, respect, and the possession of a covering. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, matra sparshas tukanteya Sichsochna sukadukada, agama payano nityas tamstitikshavab bharata. O son of Kunti, the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, O skiano bharata, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. In the conditioned state of life, the body is used as our dress, and as one needs different dresses during the summer and winter, we conditioned souls are changing bodies according to our desires. However, because the body of the Supreme Lord is full of knowledge, it needs no covering. The idea is that Krishna's body is like ours. In other words, that his body and soul are different is a misunderstanding. There are no such differences for Krishna because his body is full of knowledge. Here we receive material bodies because of lack of knowledge, but because Krishna, Vasudeva, is full of knowledge, there is no difference between his body and his soul. Krishna remembers what he said 40 million years ago to the sun god, but an ordinary being cannot remember what he said the day before yesterday. That is the difference between Krishna's body and our body. Therefore, the Lord is addressed as Vijnana Matraya Paramanda Murtaye. Because the Lord's body is full of knowledge, he always enjoys transcendental bliss. Indeed, his very form is Paramananda. This is confirmed in the Vedanta Sutra, Anandamayo Vyasat. By nature, the Lord is Anandamaya. Whenever we see Krishna, he is always full of ananda, in all circumstances. No one can make him morose. Atmana maya. He does not need to search for external enjoyment because he is self-sufficient. Shantaya. He has no anxiety. One who has to seek pleasure from other sources is always full of anxiety. Karmis, jnanis, and yogis are full of anxiety because they want something, but a devotee does not want anything. He is simply satisfied in the service of the Lord, who is fully blissful. Nivritta dvaita dristaye. In our conditioned life, our bodies have different parts. But although Krishna apparently has different bodily parts, no part of his body is different from any other part. Krishna can see with his eyes, and Krishna can see without his eyes. Therefore, in the Svetasvara Upanishad, it is said, Pashyat achakshu. He can see with his hands and legs. He does not need a particular bodily part to perform a particular action. Angani yasha sakalendriya vritimanti. He can do anything he desires with any part of his body, and therefore he is called almighty. Sorry about that, but eyes aren't what they used to be. Don't like to reveal that, but that's what this whole verse is all about. There's a theme here that's been running through the last couple of cantos, beginning with Hiranyakashipu. In the last canto, of course, we know that Hiranyakashipu, he was an extraordinary demon, and he was not an ordinary demon. He was actually a devotee who had taken birth in the material world along with Ravana. And who was the third one? The third incarnation, Sishupala, right, who had all taken birth to assist Krishna in his pastimes of killing the demons and establishing the devotees and reestablishing the disciplic succession. So Hiranyakashipu, when he was quite furious at Lord Vishnu. He was just crazy out of his mind with rage and anger and animosity towards Vishnu because Vishnu had killed his brother, Ravana. So Hiranyakashipu was just absolutely livid, and he vowed revenge against Lord Vishnu and anybody that supported Lord Vishnu or anybody that worshipped Lord Vishnu or anybody that followed Lord Vishnu would also incur his wrath, including the demigods, except for Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, who are in a special category. So when Lord Ram killed Ravana, Ravana's wives were completely beside themselves, much like the wives of Chitraketu. When their son was poisoned by the other wives who were very envious, they were all hysterical. They didn't know what to do. They were completely bewildered. They were overcome with grief and lamentation. They couldn't function. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't even do the funeral. They couldn't even do the funeral services that are required in those circumstances. So Hiranyakashipu, being quite exalted, actually, he lectured them. He preached to all the wives of Ravana about attachment to this material body and to the body of their husband. And, of course, we know that because we just finished that canto of how he explained to them that this is simply a lump of chemicals. It's simply material elements. The living force is gone. It's already moved on, and if you don't do this funeral ceremony, then this will impede the progress of the living entity to transgress or migrate into its next birth, and it will be stuck here hovering around this body while everybody laments and the body decomposes and becomes more and more unpleasant to be around. Yet the attachment is so strong that actually in some religions, I think it's the Catholic religion, they have a wake and the body is on display for a week or something like that in the casket. And they all come for a week and view the body and eat and socialize and whatever they do. And this goes on for an entire week where the body is already dead, long gone, and yet they still keep it around to worship it and say goodbye as if the living entity were actually in that body. They say, he's here. We have to go see him. We have to pay our respects. We have to say goodbye to him or her. But what are they saying goodbye to? What are they worshiping? What are they respecting? It's just a lump of chemicals. And Prabhupada, of course, uses the example many times that if the body is simply a combination of material elements that came about through some form of evolution or combination of chemicals, then why don't they simply discover that one chemical or that one gene or that one DNA combination? And of course, Drudhakarma Prabhu could explain all this much better than me. He's expert on all this stuff. Just trying to keep him awake because he knows this so well that whatever I have to say is just going to put him to sleep. But there is one very interesting story about that very point, that when I was a very young devotee, there was a very famous scientist. His name was George Wall. You remember him, Drudhakarma? George Wall, Nobel Prize winner. And he came to the University of Florida in about 1971. And there were three of us, three devotees, myself, Sudarshan from New Vrindavan, and a devotee named Hrishikesh, old devotee named Hrishikesh. I don't know where he actually joined. But we decided to go to this presentation by this scientist who was going to talk about evolution and the Big Bang and all that nice stuff that goes along with that. And we were somewhat, what's the word for it? I wouldn't say fired up. I would say a little bit irrational. To use a euphemism, we're kind of fearless and passion is a good word. We were fired up to go and challenge this Nobel scientist at this event. And there must have been 2,000-3,000 people at this auditorium for his presentation. And we were sitting right in the front row in our dhotis, shaved heads, et cetera, et cetera. And he saw us right off the bat. We were the first thing he noticed. And I can't remember the exact joke that he told when he saw us, but he made some humorous reference to our presence, and everybody laughed. And he did that deliberately to kind of neutralize what he knew was going to come, what was going to follow. Because after he made his whole presentation, we were quite very strict in terms of just repeating everything that Prabhupada told us, everything that we read in the books. We wouldn't change anything. That was like almost an apparat to even change one word of anything that Prabhupada had said. So when it came time to questions and answers, that's when he told the jokes. I got up and I was the designated protester, confrontational person, whatever. And I said, well, if life comes from chemicals and everything is simply a combination of material elements, then why can't you simply inject some chemicals into a dead body and bring that dead body back to life. And that's when he told the joke, and he avoided the answer, and everybody laughed, and he moved on to somebody else as quickly as he could, because he knew exactly what the point was. And if you think about it, today in modern science, they know so much about DNA and about in vitro fertilization and all these things about genetic engineering and stem cell research and all of these modern advances in medical science and medical research. And what are they really trying to do? What is the point of everything it is that they're trying to do? They're really trying to solve those basic problems that Prabhupada has been telling us about since 1965, birth, death, disease, and old age. And how many trillions of dollars do they spend on this every year? One caveat or side note or footnote to all this is one of the ways they do the research is they do it on animals. They do these terrible animal experiments. I actually have a case right now where I'm representing some protesters, some animal rights activists who are protesting the experiments that they do over at UCLA on these animals, and they're horrible. They're just the most, you can't even look at a picture. They're so terrible to look at, but this is the kind of stuff that they do, all in the name of modern science to solve the problems of birth, death, disease, and old age. How to just extend this life another day, another week, another year. And I was just reading a purport yesterday where Prabhupada was saying, they have all this money. Steve Jobs. I mean, how rich was Steve Jobs? Aside from the fact that he took prasadam, we all know about that, and we know there's 500 devotees now taking credit for actually cooking for him when he used to go to the Berkeley Temple, et cetera, et cetera. But notwithstanding, more power to them. You know, we know that he came, he took prasadam. He'll get the benefit of that. That's a foregone conclusion. But at the same time, here was one of the probably the five richest men in the world, 5, 10, whatever he was, wealth beyond imagination, anything we could ever dream of, more money than we could ever count in a lifetime. Invented state-of-the-art computers and all kinds of technology, things that I can't even pronounce the kind of things that he invented and that he came up with. So he was one of the smartest men on the planet. He was one of the richest men on the planet. He was one of the most famous men on the planet. He had so many opulences. He had so many opulences, wealth, power, fame. I guess you could say he was somewhat half decent looking. Wasn't Brad Pitt or anything like that, but you know, he wasn't Stephen Hawking. I didn't mean that as an insult, but you know, he had a lot of opulences going in his favor. And what happened to him? In his 50s, he contracted or was somehow came in contact with cancer. He acquired cancer. Now, interestingly, his first response was to not treat it with Western medicine, but to go and try all these alternative remedies in Mexico and diet and this and this and that and that. So we should all be careful. This is just a side note that has nothing to do with the verse, but we should be careful when we're getting up there. You know, some of us are getting to a point where we start to develop these ailments that go along with old age. There's nothing we can do about them. They just come of their own accord with the aging process. And you should be careful before you run down to Acapulco or wherever it is that they... Cancun, or I don't know what they do. Is that the vacation place or the place where they have all the alternative clinics? Whatever it is, you know, before you run down there, you should be very careful to see what kind of Western alternatives are available, because he regretted at the very end of his life that he had not done that, and he had spent a lot of time with these alternative remedies, and he ended up, like everybody else, dead. So here's a good example of somebody that had everything that one could possibly want. Even, I forgot power, what to speak of power. They classify him, and I don't want to dwell on this for too long, but he said he was one of the most, he was up there with Einstein, as one of the most influential persons of the 20th or the 21st century in terms of how he changed our culture, changed our entire way of life. The whole world now is connected in an instant. We see these revolutions going on all over the world, and even though there's all these dictatorships and all these terrible, brutal governments that are murdering their own people because of all of this technology with cell phones and all the iPads and everything else, the people in the street are actually able to photograph these things as they're taking place and then broadcast them all over the internet. And then there's a whole lexicon of terminology that has arisen in connection with this, like something that goes viral. It goes viral, it goes on the internet and then it just explodes all over the planet or something like that, goes viral. So he was behind all that. He was responsible for all that. And yet, when it came down to the bottom line, all the best doctors in the world could not save him. They could not save him. So this is the whole point of what Prabhupada is telling us over and over again. And it's ironic because if we even go back to the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, what is it in the second chapter that Krishna is telling Arjuna? You're not this body. And what is Arjuna's problem? He's attached. He's got all of these material attachments. A great devotee like Arjuna is got all of these attachments to his family, his friends, his Bhishma Dev and his cousins, even Dronacharya Guru. And everywhere he looked over the battlefield, and everywhere he looked, he saw another relative or another friend that he had gone to school with or grown up with or was a member of his family, and he was just overcome with grief. There he is, right there in the painting, where he threw down his bow and he said, Krishna, I can't do this. I just can't do this. And so we have to go through life is trials and tribulations. That's what it's all about. It really is. That's what it boils down to. The moments of happiness in this material world, if you count them up and measure them against the days and weeks and months and years of misery, then the question comes, what the hell are we doing here? What are we doing? Why are we here? How did we get here? What kind of a mess is this? Because how much is there? And Prabhupada says it's just what it boils down to in the ultimate analysis is a few minutes of sex life, a couple of minutes, and of course they're trying to extend that in various ways now. You see all these old guys walking around with these smiles on their faces, 70, 80 years old because of modern science. Because what is modern science doing for everybody? It's just doing a few basic things. Number one, it's figuring out all of these sophisticated and advanced and incredibly effective ways to destroy the world. That's number one. That's the first thing that they do. When you look at the political landscape and you look now, they're talking about the government, they're overspending, they're in debt, where are they going to cut the budget? Well, they take the money away from the poor people, take away food stamps, take away Medi-Cal, take away Social Security, take away Medicare, take away all these educational programs, raise tuition, all of these things that benefit ordinary people, common people. But if you say, take away a new version of the Abrams tank or some new fighter plane, then all hell breaks loose. Everything just completely goes. Then you see all of these guys with medals, just they can't even walk with all the medals that they have on them. They just come in, and people need to carry them into the congressional hearings because they have so many medals. And all they do is complain, oh, we need this, we need that, we need this, we need that, we need so much stuff, we need new weapons, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And there will always be war. There will always be this, because that is Krishna's way. He did it 5,000 years ago when the earth was overburdened with all of this. Creating so much pressure? What was creating so much suffering and misery on the planet? It was all these big armies that these kings were creating to fight and dominate each other. So Krishna came to wipe them out, to get rid of it, to relieve the burden on the earth of all of these armies and these weapons of destruction. In our lifetime, in my lifetime, I can't remember a single time in my lifetime, except maybe a few minutes here and a few minutes there, when there hasn't been a war going on somewhere. And I say war, serious war. Serious war. I mean, many of us were born kind of like in the aftermath of World War II. Do you know how many people died in World War II? 40 million people were killed in World War II. 20 million civilians. Europe was nothing but a rock pile. There was nothing left of Europe. It was completely crushed. It was smashed. It was just rubble. And where did these people come from? Who are these people? These Stalins and these Hitlers and these Churchills and these people. Who are they? Where do they come from? How does this all happen? And World War II was over, and World War II wasn't even over, and they were already facing off with the Russians in Berlin. Already they were fighting, dividing it all up, East Europe. Then what would you do? The Cold War, Vietnam, or rather Korea, excuse me, Vietnam. As soon as Vietnam is over, then the whole Middle East flares up. Now we're, you know, how many troops are we sending to the Middle East? And now they say, okay, we're taking the troops out of Iraq by the end of the year. But you see these little tidbits here and there. Well, now we're going to put 2,500 troops in Australia. Now, who might have a problem with 2,500 troops and a few Air Force bases in Australia? Well, maybe China. China, who owns the United States. They own us lock, stock, and barrel. They have so much money invested in this country. And yet we're now redeploying our military assets so that the military-industrial complex can continue to proliferate and maintain itself. Now they're redeploying over into Southeast Asia. And then as far as the Middle East goes, they're putting them in these little countries, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. They're putting them all over the place in little pockets here, a little pocket there. And that's not to speak of all these new drones and things that they if I stay in that position any longer, I'll be here all day. but now they can sit in Langley, Virginia, in this big room with all these computers and security cameras and everything else all over the world, satellites and so forth, and they can find a terrorist 10,000 miles away driving down a road in the middle of the desert and just blow them right off the face of the earth. And they're putting millions and billions of dollars into this now. And if we think we're solving any of these problems, and I haven't forgotten about birth, death, disease, and old age, by the way, but just to give it a more practical application, they think they're solving all of these problems, but Prabhupada once said, and I don't want to bring it up because it's, well, I'll bring it up. He said it, and everybody, a lot of us heard it, so it's not one of those controversial comments, but he said there would be a war with Pakistan. He said World War III would start with Pakistan, between India and Pakistan. And if you look at the planet right now, it's now virtually indisputable that Pakistan is the number one terrorist country on the face of the earth. The Iranians, they're doing a bunch of stuff, you know, with their nuclear weapons and all this stuff, and the Ayatollahs and so forth and so on. And they fund a little bit of this and a little bit of that. But it's just well known. The attack on Mumbai a couple of years ago, that was all engineered from Pakistan, the ISI from Pakistan. And the irony is that, you know, they all came from India originally. But Pakistan, they were all Indians, they were all Hindus. But because of the caste brahmanas, they were taxing the lower classes so heavily that they said, well, why should we be Hindus? Look how they treat us. They treat us like dirt. We might as well become Muslims. And that's how the Muslims became so powerful, because of the caste brahmanas in India. So it goes back a long way. But the point is that Pakistan, and I apologize if anybody identifies in that way, but the fact of the matter is it is the nastiest place in the entire planet in terms of festering terrorism, breeding terrorists, launching terrorist leaders from other parts of the world, and even planning attacks, and that's where they caught bin Laden. They caught bin Laden a mile or two from the west point of Pakistan. That's like catching public enemy number one two blocks from the FBI building in Washington, D.C. He was right under their nose, and they caught him right there, and the United States had to go in. So as soon as one fire, we seem to put out one fire, another one just flares up immediately, instantaneously. I mean, they're going on all the time. They don't ever go out. They just seem to go out, or they just kind of simmer down for a while, and then they flare up over here and they flare up over there. And that's where all of our money goes. That's where all of the scientific research goes. That's where the best college graduates go into the military-industrial projects, simply to create ways to destroy the world. And so when Arjuna saw all this, and of course the weapons that they had in Arjuna's time with the Brahmastras and all these weapons controlled by mantra and all these things they could do by mantra, Prabhupada was not very impressed with modern technology, because he knew that the yogis and the advanced devotees in previous ages, they could do all these things just by mantra. They could fly, they could launch all kinds of weapons. If you read the story of the fight between Sankachuta and Lord Shiva, which is a whole part of a whole pastime, as you probably all know, with Tulsi and the marriage of Tulsi and Sankachuta, or Sudam, who Sankachuta was Sudam in his former life. The weapons were just unbelievable, just so many weapons that the sky would turn black because Lord Shiva was launching all of these weapons at Sankachuta. But he couldn't kill Sankachuta. He couldn't kill him because Sankachuta was Sudam, and he had this benediction that as long as he had this amulet from Lord Vishnu, he could not be killed by anybody. So it was like a twofold strategy. Lord Vishnu said, okay, don't worry, I'll take care of it. So what he did was he disguised himself as Sankachuta. And the only way he could really get this amulet or whatever it was by breaking the chastity of Tulsi. So he disguised himself as Sankachuta, and he appeared to come back from the battle and very victorious, and she was very happy, and he pretended to be very happy. And so they had a big celebration, and that night they got together, and he tricked her and broke her chastity, and that destroyed Sankachuta's power. He lost his power to remain essentially immortal or unable to be killed. And so in the next day at the battle, when Lord Shiva just unleashed this incredible array of weapons at Sankachuta, he knew, he was a devotee, obviously Sudam, he was Krishna's most intimate friend, dearest, closest friend, and of course Tulsi was Radharani's most intimate, dearest friend, and they had both been cursed by Radharani, by the way, to take birth in the material world because they kind of made her a little angry. And so they took birth in the material world. But when Sankachuta saw all these weapons coming at him from Lord Shiva, he smiled and he bowed down and he offered his obeisances and he just left his body and he went back to the spiritual world. He didn't bother to put up a shield or counteract it with this or that. He just bowed down and offered his obeisances and went back to Goloka Vrindavan. So we know that these weapons are there, but the weapons that they have today are very crude. But the point is that we have all of this technology, all of these material comforts, all of these. It's just terrible what they have. The things that they eat is not mentionable. But before I forget, I mean, Prabhupada did say, and I heard it, we were all there in Mayapur one year in a lecture. It was a lecture in Mayapur in the temple room. Savas, I don't know if you were there or not, when Prabhupada said that World War III will start between Pakistan and India. And we were all, you know, astounded, and everybody went back and bought farms and, you know, stockpiled food or prasadam and all these things that we thought, it's coming, it's right around the block. But it's been quite a while since Prabhupada said that. But if you look at the geopolitical landscape, if you look at the state of the world, India has got nuclear weapons. Pakistan has got nuclear weapons. They hate each other. And at any moment, things could flare up. And if it's not them, who's the other player there? Well, now you've got Afghanistan, and U.S. is pulling out its troops in Afghanistan. And obviously, when that happens, all the extremists, the Muslim extremists, are going to take over. It's going to be a big civil war. Iran's going to move in. It's going to be another mess. It's going to be another disaster. And then there's China. And just for the record, as long as we're on this doom and gloom theme, I heard Prabhupada myself at a darshan in Chicago, 1974, during the Rath Yatra, the one Rath Yatra he attended there, I think. And he said there will be a war between the United States and China also. And again, we were very, you know, surprised to say the least to hear Prabhupada say this. And I actually said, I was so surprised, I said, Prabhupada, isn't there any way to avoid this? And Prabhupada just shook his head solemnly, and he said, no. He said, the Chinese are the most fallen because they will eat anything. So there must be a war. So what does that tell us? What does all this mean? This means that all of these material attachments that everybody is spending all of their time, all of their money, all of their energy trying to simply make money, to accumulate material possessions, to hire the best doctors in the world, to have all of these comforts, to make their life better and more enjoyable. But what does it all actually boil down to? It just boils down to that few minutes of sex life. You live in a nice house. You sleep in a nice bed. You go to a fancy restaurant. The belly gets satisfied. The tongue, you satisfy the taste of the tongue. It goes to the belly. The belly pushes on the genitals. And next, you know what happens after that. So at least some people know what happens after that. But that's what it's all about. And then we grow old, and there's nothing you can do about it. I saw somebody giving an interview. These celebrities that you think are so happy and so popular, and they get so much publicity and coverage and so forth. But ultimately, one of them was even admitting, yes, I get up every day and I look in the mirror, and I see what's happening. And on that George Harrison documentary that was recently on HBO, which I do not recommend that you watch it because it's not worth it, to be honest. Prabhupada is a very small, very, very small portion of it. And Krishna consciousness, great devotees like Savasantidit did so many incredible things that weren't even mentioned. But what all of these rock stars that are getting older in their 60s and so forth, what they were all talking about, and this is because George, he did some preaching. He did some good stuff. I mean, he did more than they gave him credit for, that's for sure. But he at least made them aware that there's more to life than just this material body and material possessions and trying to take a lot of drugs and music and living in big mansions and so forth. And now they're all starting to realize it. They all know, because of that seed that George planted in their consciousness, that, yes, the end is just not far down the line. I mean, I know very well that for me, it's just right around the corner. It's just not much time. I mean, most of my life is gone. And then, of course, Prahlad Maharaj explained to all his friends, well, when you add in sleeping and eating and all these other things, how much time is left? There's nothing left. It's gone. You have no time for material enjoyment. So why waste all of this energy trying to be happy in this material world? An intelligent person can figure this out without much effort. But you have to be blessed. You have to be favored and get the blessings of the pure devotee like Srila Prabhupada in order to be able to understand this. Because otherwise, you can talk till you're blue in the face to somebody. It's like talking to the wall. They just don't understand what we're talking about. They think, oh, how can, no. The doctors will figure it out. The scientists will figure it all out. We've got Botox. We've got plastic surgery. We've got lap band surgery. We've got all these things, hair transplants. And when you look in the mirror, the beauty of that is that Maya is so strong. Now, it's not that when you look in the mirror, you see some kind of a hallucination of what you think you look like when you really look like something else. Like your vision, you're like you're on an LSD trip or something, and you look in the mirror and that's not, wow, I look great. But now with all these other things, you actually do look that way. You look that way. But underneath the surface, your body is rotting. Your organs are wasting away. They're getting weaker and weaker. Our liver, our heart, our arteries are filling up with all kinds of garbage. We can't remember things anymore, as I'm a good example of. You can't walk as good as you used to be able to walk. I mean, our bodies are just betraying us. They're not our friend. Our body is our enemy. And all of these attachments, we're thinking, well, I've got to take care of my wife. I've got to take care of my children. I have to do this. I have to have a trust fund. I have to have estate planning and all that. And what's the point? It's all going to be finished. It's all going to be gone. One way or the other, it's all going to be finished. So it's the same thing. It's the same thing here. And Narada Muni has given us this incredible prayer that we could chant every day, because King Chitraketu, and he was in enormous misery, enormous anxiety, inconsolable. And what was the one thing that made him feel better? What was the one thing that gave him peace and shelter? It was the words and the instructions of the pure devotees. That was the only thing. He was the king. He was the king. And the only thing that could help him was the words of Angira and Narada Muni. So that's all I have to say. I don't know what else I can add to that. I will add one thing about something else, because I'm going to get questioned about it sooner or later. We are in the middle of the last battle over LAX. It's happening as we speak. We filed our first brief last week. We have another one, or I have another one due next week. And this is it. We either get the airport back or part of it, or it's over. It's finished. There's nothing else I can think of that we can do. So my only request is on December 4th, I talked to Savasprabhu about that. We have this Gita Mahajana, whatever it's called, but it's appropriate, because that is going to be the precise time that the judge will be making up her mind how to decide the case. So I simply request that all of the devotees, all of you, really take it seriously, really take it to heart now and through this Bhagavad Gita marathon and this Jagya, and pray to Krishna and Lord Chaitanya and Prabhupada as hard as we can, because the material odds are against us, as is usually the case, and here's an opportunity at a perfect time to really pray that we can get back the airport and start distributing hundreds of thousands of Prabhupada's books again. So.